This episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by Christendom College Graduate School, where theology is practiced with uncompromising fidelity to the deposit of faith. To learn more and to consider studying theology, go to graduate.christendom.edu.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pillar Podcast, the podcast that brings you great Catholic conversation each week. I'm your host and Pillar Editor-in-Chief, J.D. Flynn, and I'm joined by my podcasting partner and Pillar co-founder, Ed Condon. Ed, hello.
Hi, J.D. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Let's get to it. Everything old is new again in the Annuario Pontifico. The pontiff has a new old title, doesn't he?
Yes, you say everything old is new again, except for Marco Rupnik, who never changes. He's always going to be a member of the Castor.
The Annuario Pontifico, the annual Vatican yearbook, which is effectively the phone book of the Vatican City State and the directory, the official directory of all the dicasteries of the Holy See and other apparatuses of the Roman Curia, was published when? When did the 2024 Annuario come out?
I feel like it... Does it come out at the end of March? Like right before Easter?
I believe it does, sir.
Yes. I think it usually comes out right before Easter is about when they get around to.
So the new Annuario Pontifico came out, and when it did, first of all, you made a reference that we should explain. Marco Rupnik, a disgraced former Jesuit. I can't do it. I can't do it. Ed told me that this had to be a show. Ed, for some reason, wanted a show in which all we did was say the news.
Just talk about the news, not say it.
We're going to talk about the news, but, you know, it felt a little cold, if I may.
I consider you the warmest of men, JD.
I think that I bring a certain warmth to this show, but not under these strict parameters that you're imposing upon us.
I'm just asking, allow us to have a conversation naturally about the subjects that we actually want to talk about in the news, and knowing our respective natures, the sort of fraternal back and forth that you're looking for will happen naturally and run through the flesh of the conversation like well marbled beef.
Ah, good Wagyu. Mm-hmm. Should we talk about that for a while?
Not right now. No, I made a crack about Marco Rupnik. He is listed as a member of the Dicastery for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments.
In the 2024 Annuario Pontifico. Yes. So the 2024...
No surprise to anyone who reads the Pillar, because we reported that he was still listed as a member of the Dicastery like 2 months ago, because it's on their website.
It is on their website, but we had even asked ourselves at that time, is it possible they didn't just clean up the website? And lots of other people did too. And we said, well, that seems highly unlikely, because who would be inattentive to something as problematic as this? But nevertheless, now we see that if you work in the dicastery, you probably read our reporting 2 months ago that said Marco Rupnik is still listed as a member of the dicastery. And it probably might have been too late to turn the ship around on the Annuario, but...
Oh, yeah, that's all got to be in at the end of the year.
Yeah, but you'd think that... you'd think that if it was a mistake, there's some possibility that the Holy See at the time of the publication of the Annuario would say, and there's an error in here due to clerical errors, throw somebody under the bus. Father Rupnik is not meant to be listed here, whatever. Father Rupnik resigned from his role as a consultant in the dicastery for divine worship for health reasons or to spend time with his family or whatever.
Yeah, except he didn't. He's a member of the dicastery.
No, that's my whole point is...
Yeah.
It is not, as some people are saying, like confirmation that they read our reporting 2 months ago and made a choice to keep him in because, as you say, the book was in production already.
Yeah.
But there is a conscious choice not to clarify. If it were a clerical error, some people have speculated that Rupnik is still listed as a consultant to the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments. It is a conscious choice at this point not to clarify that clerical error.
Right, but the thing is, this is not you like to blame Vatican dysfunction and incompetence rather than malice or ill intent whenever possible, and I admire that in you. But other dicasteries, I mean, Marco Rupnik was put on as a member of a slate of dicasteries, and I think the most recent time they did the slates that he was on them was like 2022, so after he'd been excommunicated, in fact. Except nobody knew about that. At least the public didn't know about that. But other dicasteries have taken him off. Like they've gone to special measures to refresh their entire membership, to get him off, make sure he's not on the website, make sure he's not in the telephone book. To recognize we should not have a serially accused, horrific, blaspheming sex abuser as a member of our dicastery. It's just that the Dicastery for Divine Worship has made another choice, which is to say, it's only a 5-year term. We'll just wait it out. Eventually he'll lapse. And it's which not is a choice. If, it's yeah, not it's, a choice, but it's a choice.
It's not as if he couldn't be removed. I think he could be removed immediately by the prefect. I don't even think the pontiff would have to approve it. He could
be removed by the prefect. The Cardinal Roach could, with a stroke of his pen, say, no more. Thank you. Please remove his name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
or if you're going to insist on this, you could at least take SJ away from his name, because he's still a member of the dicastery, but he's no longer a member of the Society for Jesus. Even the Jesuits really kicked this sucker out.
Yes, they did. But that's really interesting. The enduring SJ could again be used to suggest that this is a kind of clerical error. But again, combating that is that no one has bothered to correct it, despite widespread criticism thereof.
Right. You keep saying clerical error is a possibility. Every mounting thing tells me there's no error in this. It's a choice. And the choice is, we appointed a slate of consultors to the dicastery in 2022 for a 5-year term. The list is the list. That's it. We're not changing it. The list is closed. In 2027, we'll put out a new list and there will be new consultors. So it's a choice. It's not possible to work in the Roman Curia and not know about the Rupnik situation. Like, that's not possible. It's not possible to work in a dicastery of the Roman Curia and not know that the most publicly disgraced sex abuser in the church today is a member of your committee of expert outside consultants.
Yes. What I'm saying is, definitively a choice is to allow this to continue. It is possible that at the time the book was produced, nobody just double-checked the list from last year and realized that he was still on it or something like that. But at this point, not clarifying it is the choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. There are a lot of choices. It's a never-ending series of choices that are being made to keep this guy listed. But that's not actually what we want to talk about, because we already knew.
We wanted very much to talk about the Annuario Pontifico, the annual directory the annual directory of the Roman Curia and its apparatuses.
But it's also the statistical handbook for a lot of things. Like, if you want to know how many Catholics there are in the world, if you want to know the composition of the tribunals of the various diocesan courts, that's where you go. And it is great. I mean, it is our wisdom. I was talking about this with Luke the other day, and we agreed it is basically our wisdom. And so we want it. Wisden, the Wisden Cricketer's Almanac. It is the annual statistical digest of the game of cricket everywhere in the world. It's a big yellow book. It's a beautiful thing. I get it every year.
Yeah, it is our Wisden. You're quite right. It is our Wisden.
I need to acquire a copy of this year's edition so that we can have of both Wisden and of the Annuario, so that we have those in the office.
Hold on one moment here. The pillar certainly does need to order our copy of the Annuario and pay for it. I'm not sure that the pillar needs to order and pay for our copy of the Wisden Cricketer's Almanac. I mean, again, I don't want to put my foot down here if I don't have to, but I'm not sure that we need to purchase the cricket reference book for the sake of our own pub journalism.
You don't know what use we might put it to.
Is there not a library in close proximity to you?
Where I live?
Yeah, it's a public library. Is there not a local
public library? I would be shocked to discover that the public libraries of county carry a full set of Wisden. That would be shocking to me.
I wouldn't, and I tell you for why. There are a great many West Indian migrants to your neck of the woods.
There are.
And those are cricketing people.
They are.
And some of them.
My next door neighbor is a West Indian gentleman who is a cricket fan, and he and I often exchange observations and taunts as the situation requires over the
fence. Does he have children?
He does. His children are grown.
Well, do they have children?
Some of them do, I believe, yes.
Do you think it's possible that they might need to write reports in school?
I don't know. I haven't given my neighbor's grandchildren's academic load much thought, if I'm being completely honest with you, JD.
You would have reason to conclude that your public library probably has a Wisden Cricketer's Almanac, and therefore we don't need to purchase one.
That seems silly. I prefer us to have hard copies of information. It's you can't rely on public accessibility. What the government holds on file for you, it can take away at a moment's notice. And I'm not prepared to have the various deposits of human knowledge at the behest of local bureaucrats. I think that's an unsafe thing. Do you know you can't buy an Encyclopedia Britannica anymore?
Why not? You can only license to use it on the internet or something like that.
Yeah, they're out of hard copy print, and the last hard copy edition was 2012, I think. Mm. And they're going for like 10x. Like I think yeah, it's I like imagine. $2,500 or something if you want to pick up a copy.
I can imagine.
Physical media is disappearing. It's becoming the privilege of the rich.
One of my most treasured sets of books in our home is the hard copy. It's probably a 90s version, but a full set of hard copy, the Childcraft series, the Childcraft anthology, which is a kind of encyclopedia for young children. The Childcraft anthology is an excellent, I mean, really very, very good anthology of all kinds of encyclopedic anthology of all kinds of things for young children. There's a volume on short stories and poetry. There's a volume on mathematics. There's a volume on science. There's a volume on animals and plants. There are volumes on the universe. The Childcraft series, you should go to your local library to check it out. It's basically...
I'm not going to my local library.
Wonderful encyclopedia.
You keep suggesting I go to my local library. My wife prevailed upon me several years ago. There was a vote about it, increasing funding for our local public libraries or floating a bond to fund them or something like that. And I wanted to vote no because I'm against them. Then my wife talked me into it.
You're
and
against
then I
libraries?
Yeah. Public libraries. This is what the Carnegie Foundation is for. Let them have libraries. The idea, libraries, I like to own my own books.
Okay. Well, the only thing we can do now is talk about the annuario. I don't know.
Public libraries were a very important part of my childhood, but now that you can play Oregon Trail on your phone, is there any real need to keep going there?
Well, look, I think that America's at a very critical point right now, a very sort of critical, an inflection point. And it's this: will we let books die? I think that many people are perfectly content to let books die. And you're not one of them. You don't want books to die.
No, but I want them all for myself.
Yeah.
Knowledge is power.
And you want the power.
And I want the power. I want it all to myself. You can't let the government have the power. You can't let the government have the knowledge. If you make that, and let's be honest, what's worse than the federal government is local government. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like student mm-hmm. politics. Like mm-hmm. the lower the stakes, the more venial, more petty. Like our local county apparatchiks, they are nightmarish human beings. I don't want them curating human knowledge. They're the exact worst people.
If I may, I'd bet,
yeah,
that with very little effort, uh-huh. you could get elected to a spot on the library board.
But then I'd be stuck in a room with these people where I'd have to that's the opposite of what I want. I want all of the books in my house so I don't have to rely on people like that. And you're saying, said contra, you could with very little effort
start attending committee meetings
with these people. That's not what I want.
Take the power and take the power. And then you know what you get? You're going to start ordering Wisdoms. You're going to say it's important because of the West Indian population of our county to have the whole back catalog of Wisdoms.
This is madness what you're doing. No. I'm not joining the library board. I'm just going to order the books I want and I'm going to pay for them with the company credit card because that's that's easier for me.
So thanks for subscribing, everybody. It's crucial that you do.
Yeah, quite. Now, can we talk about the annuario, please?
We can talk about the annuario. Okay, so the annuario is this annual statistical yearbook / directory, and between 1863 and 2006, the annuario listed the pontiff as the patriarch of the West, starting with Pius IX in 1863 and ending with Benedict XVI in 2006. Every year, the annuario identified the pontiff as the patriarch of the West. Before that, some popes used it, some popes didn't, starting in the 7th century.
Well, hang on. We should offer a little bit of context here. Like the first entry in the book every year is the pope, and it gives a biography of the pope, the man, his mm-hmm. baptismal name, his, you know, his thumbnail biography.
And then the all date of his of titles. His,
in all of his titles, the titles proper to the office of Pope, which in this case are, I think, in order, Bishop of Rome, Vicar of Christ, successor to the apostles, now, you know, parenthetically, if you want to use it, Patriarch of the West, Primate of all Italy, and Servant of the Servants of God?
I think it starts Vicar of Christ, successor of the Prince of the Apostles, Supreme Pontiff of the Universal Church, because it's going in descending order. Metropolitan Archbishop of the Province of Rome, Bishop of Rome, Servant of God, Servant of the Servants of God. And I don't remember where exactly Patriarch of the West gets put
West gets inserted before Primate of Italy.
Yeah, that's right. Primate of Italy is one of his titles.
Which is a weird title because the church doesn't really consider Italy to exist, or traditionally hasn't.
This is a good point. I think now, the church has full diplomatic relations with Italy, I guess, since the Lateran Treaty.
Yeah, I know we've bit the bullet and accepted the pragmatic reality, but I mean, morally, there's no such thing as Italy. There's the various city states. There's the papal states.
Bishop of Rome, Vicar of Christ, successor of the Prince of the Apostles, Supreme Pontiff of the Universal Church, Primate of Italy, Archbishop and Metropolitan of the Roman Province, Sovereign of the State of Vatican City, and Servant of the Servant of God. And Patriarch of the West does go before Primate of Italy. You're right about that.
But anyway, so yeah, within this litany, as you were saying, Patriarch of the West was dropped in 2006 by Benedict XVI, having been included in the litany of papal titles in the Annuario since Pius IX. And before that, it was kind of use it if you like. Like, it was just one of the tools in the bag.
Yeah, that's right. A pope might use it or not. And what is the history here, Ed? So the history is basically a question of
ecumenical engagement
with the patriarchs of Constantinople and Moscow.
No, it's got nothing to do with Moscow. Thanks be to God. At least so far as I understand it. But, you know, in the days of the early ecumenical councils, Nicaea, Chalcedon, Ephesus, stuff like that, there were the patriarchal sees, you know, the sort of first churches, Jerusalem, Antioch, Constantinople, Rome, Alexandria. And so four of them were Eastern, and they were, you know, the patriarchs of their proper, you know, what today we might call sort of super metropolitan provinces, mm-hmm. You know, but heads of their patriarchal churches. And then you had the Bishop of Rome, who had, you know, the Latins, effectively, the Western Roman Empire. Because when this really started getting used was when the Roman Empire and the Roman Emperor had moved court to Constantinople. And so you had the Bishop of Rome, who was like, well, and he's Patriarch of the West. Like, he's got everything over there.
Yeah, because I think it was an emperor. I think it was Theodosius or Theodosius II who first referred to a pope. So that would have been the 5th century, who first referred to a pope, a Bishop of Rome, as the Patriarch of the West.
7th century, I believe, yes.
I think that the 7th century was when popes themselves started using it, but I think the empire started using it before then.
Oh, well, if the empire started using it in the 4th century, Pope Theodosius in the 7th century, it would have been the Emperor Justinian, I guess.
There in Constantinople, you have in the 5th century, Theodosius writing to the Bishop of Rome, calling him a Patriarch of the West, or calling him the Patriarch of the West. And then I think Justinian does in the 6th century, or in the later 5th century, use it more. And then in the 7th century, Theodore I himself identifies himself as Patriarch of the West. So you have this emerging, the point is in the fracturing of the Roman Empire, you have this emerging sort of Western and Eastern identity in which the Pope sort of assumes the mantle of Patriarch of the West, among other things, while still expressing his supremacy or primacy in the whole of the church, expressing a particular responsibility for the West.
His geographical patch of immediate pastoral responsibility is recognized as the Western Roman Empire, Western Europe, as it were.
Okay, yeah.
While at the same time recognizing the particular character, history, and territory of the four Eastern patriarchal churches.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. But the title is, again, as you say, sort of a choose-your-own-adventure. So although it starts getting used then, it isn't used at a number of ecumenical councils in which the Pope is listed as a patriarch, but not listed among the patriarchs as Bishop of Rome, but not listed as the Patriarch of the West as such.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, so, I mean, what's interesting about Francis bringing this title back is really not the history of the title, I would argue. Because the history of the title has always been sort of, you know, it's a nice term. It's a nice idea.
But that can't be. I mean, do you know very much about why Pius IX started using it in 1863?
I just assumed it was because Pius IX liked a good title.
I don't know. I wonder if the idea is, amid the collapse of the papal states, the Pope is beginning to broaden. Like, what have we had since the collapse of the states? But a greater expression of the universality of the Pope's spiritual responsibility. I mean, wouldn't you agree that the papacy has been the universal spiritual authority of the Pope has been the primary emphasis since the collapse of the papal states?
Yeah. I would say that's true.
And so my theory is that, and again, a historian could correct me about this, but my theory is that Pius IX was both affirming that, but also I think possibly trying to affirm his place in the temporal realm as well. And at a time when, with the collapse of the papal states, the papacy was just becoming disempowered. I wonder if it was an expression of an intended assertion of authority or significance.
When did Father of Princes and Kings go out as a title that we used for the Pope?
I don't know.
Because I feel like Pius IX was properly had, you know, was crowned, you know, with the triple TR, the Vicar of Christ, Father of Princes of Kings, Prince of the, Successor of the Prince of the Apostles. I don't know, but they used to be the big three titles. I'm trying to remember what the third one was. Anyway, it will come to me. But all that is true, and it is interesting to speculate about why Pius IX brought the
basically
title.
Basically, what I'm saying is he starts using Annuario. It 6 years before Vatican I, right? Which asserts,
well, yeah, no,
extraordinarily the spiritual authority of the papacy. And I wonder if this is either sort of a prelude to that or an effort to kind of reassert the temporal authority of the Pope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing is, that's just the year when, that's not the year he coined it. That's just the year when he started including
putting
it in
the Annuario, right? Yeah.
So he might have been ramping up slowly, and you know, he might have been using it as like a nom de plume on things, and you know, signing stuff, you know,
Patriarchus or whatever.
Pius, Patriarch of the West. How do you like that? And it's like, I think I'll keep that one. Put that on my business card. I like that one. Because that's basically what this is it's the, it, you know, the front of the Annuario is basically the papal business card. It's the, you know, here's his resume, here's his, you know. So maybe it was that. But for me, what I think is the really interesting thing is all of the reasons the Vatican, specifically the then Pontifical Council, now Dicastery for Christian Unity, gave for why Benedict dropped it in 2006. Because, you know, if you just say, look, all of these titles are expressions, more or less apt, for the office of the Roman Pontiff, the Bishop of Rome. And the Pope picks them up and puts them down more or less at his discretion for how he, you know, how he finds they characterize his office and how he sees it and how he wants to exercise it and how he wants people to see him exercising it. But what's interesting is like the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity in 2006 made it very clear that this wasn't a stylistic choice by Benedict. It wasn't like he just didn't fancy the title and he wanted to downplay it. They called it meaningless. They said it was historically obsolete. It was theologically nonsensical. Like, they rubbished the idea that the Pope should call himself or have ever called himself Patriarch of the West. Right. They're like, this kind of flew in the, you know, in the Byzantine era when you know, the notion of the original patriarchal sees was, you know, important or whatever, but you know, this is ridiculous. You know, no one would use this now. So for Francis to readopt the title, like, I kind of feel like the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity either has to apologize for the strength of their statement rubbishing the title in 2006 or come out with the new rationale and say, well, okay, it's no longer meaningless and it clearly has meaning. And we've either discovered a new meaning or we're sorry for claiming that the old meanings were silly. So I don't know if we're going to get that. And I'm not kidding when I say I don't know if we're going to get that. Like, we may, because it must signal something. And what's interesting to me about this is they also made a big deal in 2006 when Benedict dropped this title, said, oh, well, this will be good for ecumenism, because it's the, you know, that's their deal is Christian unity. And they said, this is going to be great for chats with the Orthodox. They're going to love this, you know, and they didn't. Actually, they hated it.
Yeah, right, exactly, because it was, that was the title they thought was legitimate. It was like, no, we do think you Yes, we think you're a patriarch.
We dig that you are a patriarch of the West. In fact, we would even, if you want to go back to the early councils pre the Great Schism, we'd even go so far as to say patriarch of the West and maybe even primus inter pares. We'd like, you know, we'd give you that much.
Right, right. First among equals, we're totally cool with. It's just all this other stuff you assert. Supreme head of the universal church, where we're like, no.
Successor to the Prince of the Apostles. Wait a minute here.
Right, exactamundo.
Yeah. So they hated it, and they viewed it as, and like the, I think it was the secretary of the Orthodox Synod, like put out a statement saying that this was a sort of thinly veiled bid to assert the papacy's universal jurisdiction over the Eastern patriarchs, and you know,
right.
it showed the Pope was getting out of his Western box, and you know,
right.
So it didn't work in terms of promoting Christian unity. In fact, it seems to have backfired. But nobody's really made much of it since then, as far as I can tell. So, you know, why is it coming back now? I doubt it's for ecumenism, maybe. I mean, Patriarch Bartholomew, maybe it's to do with Easter. That's a possibility.
Maybe it's to do with Easter. Easter, we've talked about that on the show, but lining up Easter is a big priority to the Pope and the Ecumenical Patriarch. So maybe that is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you now have the Orthodox community is somewhat, has got a big fault line running through it. You have, and I don't want to generalize here, so you know, I'm going to try and pick some neutral terms. You have what you could call the good Orthodox, who are, you know, the Patriarch of Constantinople and some of the other historical patriarchal sees. And then you have what you could call, and again, I don't want to stigmatize anyone here, but like the bad Orthodox.
I would never call them that. Who on earth do you mean?
What
are you doing here?
The Patriarch of Moscow, who's all about Vladimir Putin is, you know, imbued with special divine authority to wage war on people in the name of Christ.
I have been criticizing the Patriarch of Moscow as long as you. I just am not sure you want to hear on the show call the whole of the Russian Orthodox Church the bad Orthodox.
No, I'm just talking about the leadership thereof.
okay.
But this is the hierarchical fault line that has developed, is you have a couple of either autocephalous churches or not autocephalous churches that are very much dependent on the Patriarchate of Moscow. You have the whole Ukrainian Orthodox Church versus Orthodox Church of Ukraine thing. You have, I think it's the Serbian Orthodox Church is dependent on Moscow and sort of swims in its wake. But anyway, what you might call the Bartholomew Constantinople affiliated Orthodox are very keen on sitting down for chats about Easter. They're very keen on sitting down with chats about Easter with the Catholic Church, with Pope Francis, and all of that stuff. So that's cool. And maybe this is, you know, maybe they said this, you know, it'd be really helpful if we're going to come out with a common document to be able to have, you know, to put at the bottom the patriarchs of the East and the Patriarch of the West. Like that would be nice. That would be language everybody's comfortable with.
Yeah.
If you want to just, put that line back on your business card, that would be terrific. So maybe it's to do with that.
It could be. What I find interesting about it, whether that's the case or not, and I think that's a good theory, is that, you know, Benedict who dropped the title was so in his demeanor. We talked about this at the time that he died. Benedict was so thoroughly a European, so thoroughly a man of the West that, you know, it would almost be natural for someone to call him in a sort of human sense, a patriarch of the West, because he was so thoroughly this sort of great European of like just spilling over with culture and Western intellectual formation and the Western intellectual tradition and the Western cultural tradition.
He was a one-man repository of the Western intellectual tradition.
He was like a good public library.
He was like a great private library. He was a personal library.
Yeah. Okay. I see your point. Okay. But Francis, by disposition, by intention, by design, and by action, has done something different. His parents are Italian immigrants. He's from Argentina. Both of those places are part of the West, as far as I can tell.
Well, this is part of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity's argument about the title Patriarch of the West being nonsensical. As I said, to the extent that it is referring to the Latin Church goes from Honolulu around the world to New Zealand. So
that's right.
Where's West?
But, you know, Francis has shown such keen interest in cultures beyond what we would traditionally call Western culture. No, no. Francis has shown such keen interest in cultures which extend beyond what we would traditionally call Western culture. He's so keen.
I thought you were going to call him a globalist for a second there.
Francis is part of a one world. No, he's so keen in the classical Jesuit way to get into China. He's sort of knocking on China's door in every single way he can. He's going. He just announced that he's going to Papua New Guinea, which I think is super cool because I want to go there. Do you remember the cigarette Christmas tree?
Yes.
Yeah. Vividly. So there's the cigarette Christmas tree.
Yep.
But he just announced that he's going, assuming his health allows him to Papua New Guinea.
I think Archbishop Gallagher's in Vietnam right now.
He has appointed an extraordinary number of cardinals from the Pacific Rim, from inland Asia, from sub-Saharan Africa. He is not Euro-focused in the way that Benedict would. And if you have any sense, historical sense of equating the West with Europe or European culture, which I think is a reasonable thing, Francis is not that. So from that sense, it's a very, you would never sort of naturally identify Francis as a patriarch of the West, you know, or desiring to preserve analogs between Western culture and Christian culture in the same way that you would see Benedict arguing vociferously for the Christian place of, you know, the Christian.
Benedict made it very clear. He chose his papal name. The great intellectual and evangelizing saint of Europe,
right.
Saying, you know, I'm honoring that tradition. So yeah, no, you're exactly right.
Now, Francesco, you know, the Seraphic Father was also a European, although
he had these he wandered off to what you might now call Istanbul,
Arabia. Yeah. I was thinking about him in Arabia.
Oh, Arabia too. But I thought he was in the Ottoman court for a while.
He was everywhere.
He was.
He was everywhere. So he had this missionary impulse sort of from the West, whereas Saint Benedict built the West. So like by disposition or nature, you wouldn't sort of line those things up in the way that they line up. But I think you're probably right that there probably is an ecumenical core at what's going on here.
Yeah. Let's talk about this more in a moment.
Okay. Ed, this week's episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to us by the Christendom College Graduate School of Theology, the first graduate program to attain recognition by the Newman Guide, which helps students and parents identify faithful Catholic colleges and schools.
That's right. It is the Christendom Graduate School is founded in 1969 as the Notre Dame Apostolic Catechetical Institute, the first school in the Pontifical Center movement, and the first Catholic higher education institution founded to address the burgeoning crisis of theological dissent, which was a real deal back then in the United States. Mm-hmm. The Institute merged with Christendom College in 1997 and became Christendom's graduate school. And this spring, you should consider taking courses in subjects including the Joannine Corpus, Holy Spirit and Ecclesiology, Liturgy and Sacraments, and Catholic Social Teaching. I would particularly recommend the course on ecclesiology because I firmly believe you can't talk about anything almost in the life of the church without touching ecclesiology, without understanding ecclesiology. So I'd go for that one. What about you, JD?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I also think the courses on pneumatology, the Joannine Corpus sound really interesting, sacramental theology, Catholic social teaching. All of these courses engage deeply with magisterial texts themselves, with a special focus on the Second Vatican Council, which gives direction to the life of the church today. So it is critically important, I think, to engage for anybody who wants to be theologically informed in the life of the church today, to engage concretely with the Second Vatican Council, which is exactly what Christendom College Graduate School of Theology is doing. The courses are taught, Ed, in a hybrid fashion. That means you can show up in person on Christendom's scenic Shenandoah Valley campus in Virginia, or you can study online. So listen, guys, you guys are theologically engaged and interested in the life of the church, and we know that because you listen to the Pillar Podcast. So you should think about applying for a master's degree in theology today or just taking a course for enrichment. If you teach or hand on the faith, if you are a formator, a catechist, an evangelist in some way, if you are in pastoral ministry or educational ministry, or if you just take the Great Commission seriously, you need some serious intellectual formation in the life of the church. And the Christendom College Graduate School of Theology is a great place to get it. So, Ed, where can they go?
They can learn all they need to know at graduate.christendom.edu.
Graduate.christendom.edu.
Okay, real talk, JD.
Real talk. We're talking Patriarch of the West.
It's about synodality, isn't it?
Oh, I don't see the synodality connection, but everything Everything is about synodality.
How could you not see this? Everything is about synodality. So there has to be one. And once you've understood that everything is about synodality and that there has to be one, it becomes very clear. Because if you, okay, put it this way, the pontifical council, now the Dicastery for Christian Unity, said, oh, and the other reason we don't like this patriarchal title is we in the West, it's like, because we have bishops' conferences now.
Yeah,
and we even have super international weird meetings of bishops' conferences.
That was super weird. We have
beautiful administrative bodies and committees. We don't do this patriarchal.
The canonical order adapted to today's needs, said the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except it is no longer the canonical order for today's needs, we have been told. The synodal order is the order of the day.
Synodality. It's what you need for today's church. Synodality. Synodality. Right.
And so you don't. So the Pope convenes an ecumenical council for sure. And we do not have an ecumenical council going. We do have
synodality is not an ecumenical council. That's a fair point. Thank you.
And you have diocesan bishops, and they can have diocesan synods. You can have metropolitan archbishops who can have provincial synods.
Yes, they could.
But what sits above an archbishop? A patriarch. This is what they were traditionally.
I don't
get it.
The Pope could call a synod for the Latin Church as well if he wanted, right? I mean, the Pope.
He could, and he has, but he's, I mean, that's effectively what the synod and synodality is. But
synodality,
if you're
sorry.
I'm saying, is he bringing back Patriarch of the West because it's actually a synodal title, not an ecumenical title?
I see, because synods are great patriarchs sort of sitting cross-legged on pillows, like if you had a pope who said, and
right,
saying,
if you
yes,
had a pope who really wanted to make
carefully.
Bishops' conferences their thing. Like bishops' conferences were going to be the modus vivendi of the church in the third millennium.
Then he would title himself president of the bishops' conference of the conference
exactly.
of the bishops of the bishops of the conferences. Yeah.
Permanent chairman and executive secretary of the, that would make it into the Annuario.
Yeah, that's a good point. But patriarch just evokes this sort of vaguely Eastern notion of synodality and gives it to us like, yes, yeah. We're here for serious contemplation and possibly a hookah.
I don't know that I'd go that far.
The synod on synodality would be enriched terrifically by the presence of hookahs every third round table.
Well, that probably is true. I mean, they do have a bar, which I really appreciated when I saw that they'd include. I thought that showed careful attention to what people needed. Because talking to the participants last October, they were all agreed that almost everyone we talked to said, you needed a drink at the end of the day, so that they had a full bar in the Paul the Sixth Hall was probably a mercy. Mm-hmm. But hookahs could help. I mean, why not? There has to be a suggestion. What is the synod on synodality about? It's not allowing Catholics to feed into the process.
A suggestion box. That's a very good point.
There should be.
Point, sir. Oh, to be sure. I mean, theologically, there should be.
Yeah. I mean, it's one big suggestion box.
Yeah. Just, okay.
It's got a very narrow slot in the suggestion box through which only 1% of Catholics can participate.
We shall find out whether it's you, me, Luke, Michelle, or Edgar, hopefully at the Synod on Synodality in October. Someone should ask at the press conference, is the title Patriarch of the West all about synodality?
I think we're going to end up asking before that. I think this sounds like a trivial story, but I don't. I think it's got legs. People want to know. You don't just bring back a new or an old papal title mm-hmm. into the Annuario for no reason. Mm-hmm. Like someone has to pull the trigger on that one, and it has to be the Pope. Mm-hmm. And it means something. Francis didn't just wake up one day and say, "Yeah, Patriarch of the West, I like that." You know, it's not like going through the. Remember when Benedict would make a great point of going through the wardrobe and, bringing out the old, the papal Santa hat and, getting the old gear out and wearing it. It's not like Francis was filing through the, what other names do I have at my disposal? I'll just try these on. Like he made this decision for a particular reason and it means something.
Yeah.
And people want to know what it is.
You're right about
that. So I think someone's going to have to give an explanation.
You're right about that. No,
I hope it's not Cardinal Fernandez.
Okay, let's
then we'll have to have a whole declaration.
Let's talk about Cardinal Fernandez, because on Monday was released Dignitas Infinita. Dignitas Infinita in the singular.
Yes.
Not in the singular. But what Ed, let's hear your takeaways.
It was exactly what we thought it would be.
It was what we said it was.
It annoyed all of the people we predicted it would annoy. The New York Times editorial board are furious. I saw exactly the kind of ridiculous game being played online that we thought about, you know, who's trying to attribute this directly and personally to Pope Francis and who is trying very hard to distance.
Oh, did you really see red pen, gold pen analysis of Dignitas Infinita?
Oh, yeah. This is a papal document. This is not a papal document. This is Pope Francis slamming this. This is not Pope. This is the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith slamming this. And, you know, got to ask, is this, you know, how involved was Pope Francis in this and how clear was he on, you know, what's going on here? Oh, I saw all of that shenanigans. As we thought we would. So yeah, it does exactly what it says on the tin, or I should say rather, it does exactly what Cardinal Fernandez had been saying for the last several months it would do. And it did it for all of the people that he suggested it would do it for. And you know, that's nice. I had the lingering question of, you know, do we really need a document addressing these issues? But I think this was a very good one. I think this was very helpful. I think it was very coherent. I think it has addressed controversial issues of the moment in a systematic way that is also comprehensible for people. So I think it is a document with clear utility in that.
Yeah,
in that
and I
way.
Think the framing, the dignity framing, is a framing that resonates with the contemporary human experience, right? I mean, so the text at the beginning sort of mentioned the UN Declaration on Universal Human Rights, and I think the publication date was an anniversary of the Declaration on Human Rights or something like that. But the text both draws from the sort of contemporary interest in the notion of human dignity and challenges it and elevates it. So it says, look, human dignity is not just unlimited choice, even if you think that's what it means. Human dignity is not just an absence of suffering. In fact, on the contrary, human dignity is knowing what to do with suffering. Human dignity is not just, to challenge sort of the other side, human dignity is not just something which is earned by good behavior, which only exists in the presence of good behavior. Sure, there's a thing called moral dignity. Sure, there's a thing called social dignity. Sure, there's a thing, there are other kinds of dignity. But there's also this kind of ontological dignity, which comes from being made in the image of likeness of God. So what I liked about the framing of this document very much, most people have, I think, focused on the issues, right? What does it say about LGBT? What does it say about assisted suicide? What does it say about surrogacy? But the framing of the document is where I think the thing really sings, so to speak, in that it takes a word that has a lot of contemporary resonance and really bores into it in such a way that I really benefited from the sort of fourfold unpacking of notions of dignity.
It's a very natural law document.
Well, I know that... I think it was – we had this cool thing where we had these moral theologians sort of writing their sort of analysis of it as they read it. And I think that was one of the points that moral theologian Father Tom Berg, who is at Dunwoody Seminary, mentioned, is that the text is a sort of natural law approach, which is not usually the Francis magisterial approach.
No, but I mean you can't really talk about human dignity as the church understands it and roots it without talking about natural law because – you know, you go through what it says, and it's all about human nature. But human nature as creatures exists in the created order, exists in this totality of creation that God has created and seen that it was very good. That there is an order to creation, and that is fundamentally the church's understanding of natural law, which is something you can't talk about if you're, for example, at the UN. And I think that is maybe if there was a theme that I would like to see picked up in more church documents speaking into the debates of our times, I think it would be reminding, representing, and championing the church's right understanding of where human rights and human dignity are situated and from whence do they come, as in this document reminds us, because we are created in the image and likeness of God. Because you see this humanist positivism so clearly in the other side of exactly the debates that Dignitas Infinita is wading into, of people saying, you know, well, your rights come from the state, your rights come from law, your rights come from democracy, quote unquote. And that's, you know, that kind of positivism is actually a stripping away of human dignity, because it simply says, well, your dignity, your rights are granted to you by other people and are subject to the approval of other people, whether they, you know, be the, you know, the right sort of cast of other people who happen to be in charge, or the sort of broad popular vote of other people. You know, that is what defines human dignity. And that is, of course, completely wrong. So I love that about this document.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I do think that because of the framing that it offers, and a way of thinking about dignity as a sort of framework for moral assessment, which is not novel, which exists in Evangelium Vitae and other things, you know, which is, I think, in many ways a hallmark of the JP2 papacy, but kind of taking that up again and then applying it sort of across the board as a framework for assessing a number of sort of moral issues. I think this document, you know, you hear me say a lot on this show, like, oh, it's another magisterial document or it's another conference document and cool, we'll fight about it for a long time and it'll go on the shelf and no one will read it again. I actually think Dignitas Infinita might be one of the more lasting documents of the Francis papacy, because it has, I think, real sort of catechetical value. Like, you could easily use this text, which is not very long, as a framework for a Catholic high school moral theology class or university level moral theology class in a way that you really couldn't with sort of Fratelli Tutti or something like that. I think that the documents of the Francis papacy, when I think about the two teaching documents that I think will endure, Laudato Si has not yet come into its own, because people sort of had this initial visceral reaction of like, oh, the Pope doesn't like air conditioning, blah, blah, blah. And people didn't like it because they gave it this extremely surface reading. But Laudato Si is really a document about anthropology and from anthropology economics, which is, in as much as economics is something, it's a daughter of anthropology. I know there are economists listening now who are like, in as much as, but I mean, yeah, economics is a kind of facet of anthropological reflection, I think.
It's that or it's witchcraft.
But I think Laudato Si's
economics, JD.
I think Laudato Si has staying power, but it has not yet come into its own. And then I think this text has much more staying power. I think if I'm thinking, what are the Francis texts that we're reading in the next papacy? A lot of people say that about Evangelii Gaudium, but it's very lengthy and it's
mostly written by Benedict.
Evangelii Gaudium?
Sorry, no, I'm sorry. No, you're right.
Lumen Fidei. Yeah, I count Lumen Fidei as a Benedict encyclical. So Lumen Fidei finishes the Benedict triptych
Deus Caritas Est
and Spes Salvi and then Lumen Fidei.
Yeah.
So I count it as a Benedict encyclical. But I think this one has stung, because I think that framework is useful and valuable. Now, look, the text is not without controversy. There are lots of people debating sort of right now, what does it say about the death penalty? In the same way they're debating constantly, what is Francis saying about the death penalty? The question that many people have is Francis, with all of his rhetoric about the death penalty, trying to develop the church's doctrine in such a way as to say that the death penalty is an intrinsically evil act, that execution is always wrong? And people say, well, that can't be, because the church has already allowed for the possibility of the death penalty, either in limited circumstances or retribution, et cetera. And so while there can be prudential judgment about the use of the death penalty in contemporary society, that you can't sort of declare the death penalty to be intrinsically evil. I think part of the way to think through that is to think about whether or not execution in the contemporary milieu is the same moral act as execution in other milieus, or to develop execution in the framework of just war theory. You know, I think there is a way to navigate what Francis says about it. The sort of absolutist position that the death penalty is intrinsically evil, I don't think doctrine can develop there, because doctrine can't develop.
That's not a development, that's a reversal.
Right, exactly. But the notion of the absolute moral abhorrence of the death penalty in the contemporary milieu is an application of that, which I think Catholics can get to very easily.
I am surprised by and slightly uncomfortable with the Pope's language on the death penalty, much of which is quoted in Dignitas Infinita, because it is so strident. It uses words like inalienable and things like that that have this sort of lilt of it always was and always will be wrong to them, although it doesn't expressly say that. And the reason I'm uncomfortable is like, why not just lay out a very clear case for saying, we don't need the death penalty anymore. We don't. And so we don't have to have it. We can speak about it in these terms about this is the fullness of the Christian witness is better presented in being, you know, absolutely, authentically, 100% pro-life in every circumstance. Like, you know, there, you can say all of that. Like, why do you have to have the sort of flirtation with, oh, and it's always been wrong? I just don't understand. And I say that to someone like, I am against the death penalty. I don't need to see it practiced. I don't need it on the statute books. I would like to stop every execution that is on the books in this country. That is like, I have no axe to grind, pardon the whatever, with the practice of capital punishment. Like, I want it, I would love to stop it. So I'm sympathetic to the direction the Pope is headed in here, but I just don't understand why he seems to be doing it in a way that keeps provoking this.
I think the pontiff wants doctrine to develop in this way. I really do. I think the pontiff
but it can't.
Wants. Yeah. No. Yeah, that's the problem.
That's my point. Is like it's no, and mm-hmm. and that I think is why people get. I mean, you do. There are some people, and you see them who just like. Who love themselves some death penalty. Like they think that it is actually good.
I once heard a Republican governor say, the reason we need to use the death penalty in this state more often is because we shouldn't have to pay for these monsters to eat.
Right.
And that's that's not Catholic reasoning about it. Then he got an award for being a super pro-life governor because he did some stuff about abortion that he should have done, but you know.
Right. So there is that sort of mentality out there, but I just, yeah, there are a lot of people who get very alarmed about Pope Francis and the death penalty, not because they have any particular stake in the
because it's a doctrinal question.
Because he's making this bizarre, it's a weird branch for him to try and saw out the church's doctrinal authority out from underneath itself. Like nobody, you know, is fighting him saying, we need more executions in the world, Your Holiness, and you're rowing in the opposite direction. Like JP2 had already blazed the trail and been like, we need to say yes to life. We, you know, he was very clear on, you know, the what he considered to be the admissibility of the death penalty, all of this stuff. And I mean, in the early years of the Francis pontificate, you got people saying, "Ah, oh, well, this is the thinnest edge of the wedge. This is the Pope, you know, test. This is his test case. And if he can successfully carry the idea that doctrine can develop in a way that is effectively a U-turn and a refutation of itself, then he can apply this anywhere." But Francis has been Pope for more than a decade. He's 87 years old. Like, I don't think he's still, you know, tiptoeing around, you know, a test case for being able to just, you know, throw all of doctrine up for grabs with this thing. Like, I think it is, he's speaking about this particular issue in a particular way for particular reasons to this issue. And I just don't understand why he chooses to do it.
You know, we're not going to solve this today.
No, we're not.
But I've heard an argument that I think is interesting that I'd love to hear a response to. So take Pius XII, right? Pius XII says,
please take him. Sorry, Pius, I know how much you like Rodney Dangerfield.
I do, although he's very filthy. Pius XII says, Pius XII gets no respect. Pius XII says, when there's the question of the execution of a condemned man, the state does not dispose of the individual's right to life. In this case, it is reserved to the public power to deprive the condemned person of the enjoyment of life and expiation of his crime. An expiation of his crime. When by his crime, he has already dispossessed himself of his right to life. Pius XII defends the death penalty by saying this person has committed a kind of moral suicide, Avery Dulles calls it, right? Mm-hmm. And Pius XII's framework can be looked at as a synthesis of what has preceded it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Then JP2, so we have sort of four traditional sort of uses of the death penalty. We have four traditional uses of punishment, which the church has traditionally said that the death penalty can sort of fit into them. Rehabilitation, social safety, deterrence and retribution, right? And JP2 says, look, we can meet all of those without recourse to the death penalty. And so we shouldn't use the death penalty, and we shouldn't use the death penalty unless we can't meet them without recourse to the death penalty.
I agree with the second part. It's the first part where I think JP2, and this is an important point, JP2 is open to...
Yeah, in my view. JP2 says effectively, in my view, we can meet all
but
of them.
He's open to challenge, but more importantly, he's open to circumstances.
Right.
So, for example, even after Pope Francis changed the language of the catechism on the death penalty, it was Cardinal Malcolm Ranji of Sri Lanka, who was still calling for the death penalty mm-hmm. to be used in Sri Lanka and saying, I am aware of what the church, I'm aware of where Pope Francis wants to go with the death penalty and everything. And I think it's great. And I'm aware of what the church has always taught on the death penalty. And here we need it. We don't need, I'm not saying, Cardinal Ranji wasn't saying like, you know, all murder should be treated as capital crime and you should forfeit your life, or all, you know, people who, you know, this class of criminal, or it should be available for, he was arguing for it in very particular circumstances, which were basically cartel bosses in prison who were still waging campaigns of assassination outside of prison while they were supposedly in solitary confinement, saying, we have no other way of protecting society from these individuals.
Yeah.
Like right. Our society is not developed in such a way that we are capable of depriving these people of the ability to continue taking innocent human life.
Yeah.
They're still whacking witnesses. They're still, you know.
That's just it, is that the sort of classical formulation is, we have these reasons for punishment. The person has dispossessed himself of his right to life, as Pius XII has said. And at the same time, the state should not make recourse to the death penalty when the evil effects outweigh the good effects. So if there if there's more participation in evil by the participation of death penalty, or where there's more consequence of evil by participation in the death penalty or use of the death penalty than not, then we shouldn't use it. And JP2 says, well, that seems to me to be the case all the time. Francis seems to be wanting to sort of absolutize that. So it's JP2 who sort of does turn the tide by introducing, I have this personal view on it. And then Francis seems to be wanting to absolutize that.
Yes.
In a certain way, I see an analogy there with Familiaris Consortio and Amoris Laetitia, where JP2 says in Amoris Laetitia, in Familiaris Consortio, look, traditionally it has been the case that we say that divorced and remarried people can't ever receive Holy Communion. I see this sort of, and here's the principles of that. And I see this way by which divorced and remarried people who remain cohabitous with one another, remain by external sort of observation, living in more exoria with one another, in the mode of being married with one another, could receive Holy Communion if indeed they are not engaged in sexual relations with one another and if there's no occasion for scandal. In other words, JP2 sort of says, here's my view on how to assess those genuine sort of doctrinal concerns in this pastoral context. And then Francis, in a certain way, wants to absolutize that a little bit more in Amoris Laetitia, or take it to another level. But it's JP2 who did sort of open the door, it seems to me, to some extent, for Francis drawing the JP2 argument to a categorically different level, or a change in not only degree but kind.
Yeah,
no, that, yeah. I mean, the reason I raise that is because I think there are people who say about both of those things, oh no, JP2 opened the door and Francis is just walking through it on both the death penalty and Amoris Laetitia. But it seems to me that what JP2 did is take arguments to their natural consequence, like, and then make his own sort of objective, or make his own subjective assertion of assessment of the state of play. And then Francis sort of makes a sort of categorical shift from there in the case of the death penalty to say, this is an absolute moral norm. And in the case of marriage, ironically, to say, this question of living in more exoria is not an absolute moral norm. There can be qualified differences in these kinds of things.
I think that's a very interesting way of presenting it. I like that.
Okay. Well, Edward.
Yes.
My question is this. Mm-hmm. I know you really wanted us to buy the Wisden Cricketer's Almanac.
It's a great book.
But I don't know how much we need it. Because you do know a lot about cricket, and I think you know more about cricket than you give yourself credit for.
Not statistically.
Not statistically?
I am a spiritual student of the game. I love cricket as the game and as the playing of the game. I'm not a stat nerd of cricket.
No, no, but you know a little bit about cricket.
I do know a little bit about cricket, yes. But I mean, as James wrote, what do they know of cricket, they who only cricket know?
Fair. So I have a list of cricket questions that get harder as we go on.
Okay.
And I want to just see how deep into the questions you can get, because if you can get pretty deep into them, maybe we don't need Wisden. Or maybe on the other hand, if we can get very deep into them, maybe you deserve Wisden and you appreciate it. So I'll say
this. We'll find out. All right.
If you can get to 15, Pillar is not buying you wisdom. But I personally buy you wisdom.
That's very sweet.
On my list of difficult trivia questions.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Ed, the second most popular sport in the world after soccer, which sport has defensive positions named gully, silly, mid-off, and deep mid-wicket?
Oh, well, this is cricket.
Great. Wonderful. Well done. One down.
Thank you.
As part of its effort to break into the Indian market, Nike released the what to target cricket players?
This is an item? This is a product?
It's a shoe line. The Air Zoom blank.
I have no idea. I want a pair now, though. I didn't realize Nike made a special cricket shoe for India.
Okay, this is a hard one. So I'm going to give you one pass.
No, that was a hard one.
Yeah, I'm going to give you one pass, and we'll keep going because I don't want the game to end so quickly. The Air Zoom Yorker.
Oh, interesting. Does it have like special? A Yorker is a delivery in cricket where, so you're familiar with the basic mechanics of cricket bowling, where you have to have a straight arm, you can't bend the elbow. You pitch the ball so that it bounces once towards the wicket, which is the three sticks in the ground. The wicket is sticky. Yeah, very funny. The three sticks. Yes. But you're trying to hit the wooden stumps, having bounced the ball once, right? And it's the batter's job to stop that, to defend the wicket, to defend those wooden stumps from the ball. That much is clear?
Yes.
A Yorker is a delivery where the ball is pitched so as not to bounce in between the bowler, brackets, pitcher, for your understanding, and the batter, but actually drops right at the batter's feet, sort of aimed at their toes. And so the idea is that the batter will then pull up short and it'll sneak underneath his bat and, you know, he'll be faced with either crippling toe pain or it might sneak through underneath and hit the stumps. So if Nike are making a kind of cricket shoe that's called a Yorker, I'm guessing, does it have like reinforced toes? Does it have like steel toe caps?
The Air Zoom Yorker. Cool. I don't know if it has steel toes, but the toes, I'm looking at it. The toes look pretty solid to me.
I like it.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, that was your first. I'm giving you a pass on that one.
Okay.
Ed, cashmere and this wood are the two most common materials for. Would you like to be a little more specific?
English willow.
English willow are the two most common materials for constructing the cricket bat.
Yes.
Ed, what nation was banned from international cricket from 1970 to 1992?
South Africa.
Great. You're in question four already. Ed, in the late
my games teacher and cricket coach in secondary school and high school was a former. I think he was only capped once for England, but he actually went on a rebel tour of South Africa as a player. He broke the embargo and went and played a tour in South Africa with other professionals.
Wow, that's terrible.
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, we couldn't understand it because he's black. He was a black player. And so to go and play in apartheid South Africa, we just couldn't understand it. We thought it was very, very odd. But he was a great coach.
Wow, that's really very odd. Okay. Ed, in the late 1800s, the former cricketer Henry Chadwick devised the box score for what other sport?
Baseball.
Correctamundo. Ed, in the oldest written record of cricket, there is a 1611 entry in which two parishioners in Sussex, England, failed to attend church because they were playing cricket. What holiday did these men skip?
Whitsun. Pentecost.
Sorry, I would like you to continue. Did you say Pentecost or did you say something which precedes it a little while?
Whitsun, I said. But the Whitsun bank holiday, the Pentecost bank holiday, was it... Was it Pentecost? Was the day they missed?
I'm not going to answer because I still want you Easter? To think about it. Easter it is, Ed. You're right. Oh. It was Easter. Wow, you know so much about cricket. That's great.
Can I just ask, did you say this was the first recorded instance of cricket?
It says in the oldest written record of the sport of cricket. There's
no, that's 1611 that's entry. Actually this must be a legend or some kind. It might be the first recorded of the game, but the first recorded reference to cricket being played was actually by students of my alma mater. School lays claim to being the oldest recorded.
What school is that again? And I don't think that watercoolertrivia.com is going to be wrong about this stuff.
Your mileage may vary on your deep knowledge of the sources.
Okay. Originally known as the Sheffield Shield, this first-class cricket competition crowns a domestic champion from the six states of what nation?
Australia.
In the 2014 Disney sports movie Million Dollar Arm, two cricket players are recruited to play baseball by an agent portrayed by what American actor best known for playing Don Draper?
John Hamm. John Hamm.
You're 8 questions up, man. You're almost to Wisden. What country's national cricket team is known as the Men in Blue?
I mean, I presume India because they play. It's India or Sri Lanka.
India it is. You are 9 questions up. How many inches is the circumference of a standard cricket ball?
Oh.
You're in question 10 now. That's getting hard.
How
many inches is the circumference of a standard cricket ball?
I'm really bad at spatial guessing things.
Okay, I'll accept any response within an inch of the correct answer.
Okay. I don't want to get this wrong because I know I'm playing for real money here.
You're playing for real money.
I'm going to say 8 inches.
And I am so sorry.
Oh.
It is 9.1 inches.
Oh,
you were off by 1/10 of an inch.
Shoot.
I'm so sorry. Well, that was fun. That was fun.
I enjoyed that. That was a test.
A couple of other questions just for fun.
Give me one more just for the sake of it.
Give you one more. Boy, I got to really find a hard one here. I'm going to go way deep into the quiz here. The slang term duck in cricket typically refers to what score for a batsman?
Oh, that's 0. That's an easy question.
Use that in a sentence. I don't understand it.
He was out for a duck. You also have a golden duck, which is you're out for a score of 0 on the first ball you face.
A duck means he didn't get any points. He struck out.
He scored no runs.
He struck out.
Yes. You can have – so that's a duck is you scored 0 personally.
So he could have a pop fly and then – like could there be a sacrifice duck?
No. There's no such
– If you get a duck, could you still get an RBI?
No. You score your runs individually because you're batting in pairs, and every time you switch places between the wickets, it's a run.
And wait a minute.
Run is accredited to the batter who struck the ball.
So there's nobody on base when you're running.
Yeah, there's always someone on the other opposite end, and you have to switch places. Like, did you ever play running bases as a child?
Sounds like a version of cricket.
Yes. And so if you're facing the bowler, the all runs scored off of that strike are accredited to you, even though it requires both batters to...
Both of you are running back and forth.
Yes. Every time you switch places, one run is scored.
Is the other batter then in close proximity to the pitcher?
Yes.
Is he talking trash to
him? Oh, constantly. It's called sledging in cricket.
He's sledging. Yes. He's just saying like, boy, your mother's got better cricket mechanics than you.
I will give you an example of a prize cricket sledge.
Okay.
This was done between the sort of legendary England and Australia teams of the 80s and 90s. But one of them, the English wicketkeeper asked the Australian batsman, "How come you're so fat?" And he responded,
"Oh no, that's terrible. That's
the sort of sledging that goes on in cricket."
Did they ever mic up the guy so that you can listen to it on television?
They do have mics on the stumps sometimes, which they use to sort of help determine outs. Like, did the ball properly graze the bat? Was it a catch? Was it, you know? And they have to be somewhat judicious with the audio they make available for television.
Ed, what is the name for a cricket scoop in which a batsman is down on one knee and hits the ball over the wicket keeper's head?
Hook. He's hooking.
Mm. What, first of all, what's a scoop?
That means I don't hitting know. I mean, this is a descriptive term here. This is not a technical term.
This is the name for this. The name of this thing is a dill scoop.
A dill scoop. Oh, then this would be a batting technique. I mean, this is what you're describing is hooking. He's down on one knee. He's hooking it behind his head. It's a. Oh no, you sit down on one knee. So I guess it would be a sweep.
Scoop.
So a sweep is you're keeping the ball along the ground. In this case, you're getting down on one knee, bat forward. And you're playing the ball off the ground and up into the air behind you.
So like a bunt.
Yeah. I mean, the effect is similar. Yes.
Okay. The effect is similar. I thought so. Yeah. LBW is an initialism for what phrase, which is considered one of the 10 ways in which a batsman can be dismissed?
Leg before wicket.
Leg before wicket. What does that mean?
It means basically that you are judged to be out because the ball having pitched then struck the batsman on a line which, if it had continued unimpeded by contact with the batsman, would have disturbed the stumps.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, Ed, thank you very much for this. I've certainly found it interesting.
I dare say you haven't learned much, but that's fine.
This week's episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by the Christendom College Graduate School of Theology. You can check it out at graduate.christendom.edu, graduate.christendom.edu. The Pillar Podcast is a production of Pillar Media and Ed and JD Production. Our executive producer is Kate Oliveira. I'm your host, JD Flynn. My podcasting partner is Ed Condon. And Ed, please tell your mother I said thanks for that box of cookies.